Book 3, Manifestation to Israel, Chapter 1, The Passover and the Temple. The time had now fully come for Jesus to manifest himself to Israel. Pausing only a few days in the homes of his small band of followers at Capernaum, he left Galilee so that he might be in the city and sanctuary of God in time for the Passover. The only appropriate place for him to reveal himself was in Jerusalem, and there could be no more fitting occasion than the feast of the Passover. The rulers must be given the first opportunity of accepting their Messiah. But the advent of Christ meant a purge. It could not have been otherwise. Wherever self-interest and fleshly ambitions order men's lives, the coming of Christ will mean a sweeping away of everything which does despite to the Spirit of grace. Year by year, Jesus had gone up to the temple. Each visit would reveal more of the greed and injustice of those responsible for the ordered worship of God. It was necessary for the people to bring offerings, and it was convenient that they should be readily available. It was important that the temple levies should be required in the form of a standard half-shekel coin in view of the thousands of foreign Jews who came from all parts of the empire. Arrangements were therefore made for the sale of animals and the exchange of foreign money, from which the Levites and high priestly families found a source of immense profit. And establishing a monopoly had imposed more and more abuses upon the people who came to worship. Those who did not purchase their sacrifices in the temple courts were not immune from the avarice of the priests, because they had to submit them to the inspection of qualified examiners, who were authorized to charge for each animal. These examiners were subject to human frailties and increased their revenue by receiving bribes when they found real or imaginary faults in the animals submitted to them. The activities of the money changers were not confined to changing enough foreign money for the temple levy and the animal offerings, but they negotiated all sorts of financial transactions. Many of their dealings led to violent dispute and not infrequently to blows and riots which needed the attention of the temple police. These desecrations, mingling with the noise of literally thousands of animals driven through the seething masses of worshippers, made up a scene of pandemonium which must have brought smiles of contempt from the watchful Roman sentries on the walls above. They evoked a burning indignation in the heart of Jesus, which frequent visits only served to intensify. Now the time had come to open his ministry, and he did not spare. Twisting some cords into a whip, he drove the animals from the owners towards the great gates. He flung tables aside, scattering the piles of money. Men cringed in fear before him. "Take these things hence! Make not my Father's house a house of merchandise!" Slowly the storm subsided, but no man opposed him. Those responsible for the desecration came forward, but their attack was frustrated before it could begin by the silent figure standing before them, his eyes blazing with anger and challenge. Looking upon him, they recognized their guilt and were powerless to charge him. There was a heavenly bearing about him, which took their minds back to the wilderness and the Baptist. They remembered his proclamation of the coming Messiah. It was with no conscious deliberation that this man had spoken of the temple as "my Father's house." Was it possible? Finally, one became the spokesman of them all, but his arrogance evaporated in the presence of this scourging anger. "What sign showest thou us, seeing thou doest these things?" If these words were in any way a renewal of the wilderness temptation, "Cast thyself down," Jesus gave no indication of it. He corrected the subtle mistake of his questioner, who was only entitled to ask Jesus to give a sign and not to show one, to establish his authority as a prophet. "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." This was no empty challenge. It was a prophecy. The men who were responsible for these crushing abuses were the men who were to be ultimately responsible for the calamities of AD 70, when the temple, the city, and the land were lost amid indescribable horrors. Yet the temple then had done its work. It had been replaced by an eternal sanctuary, the chief cornerstone of which was the Son of God. In the act of condemning the temple rulers, Jesus takes the first step along the road which will lead to his crucifixion. But in that act, his body will fulfill the function which was only typified by the temple and its services, and his resurrection will be the final vindication of his authority. The Jews did not forget these words of Jesus, nor did they ever forgive him for them. They misquoted them in their effort to condemn him and thus establish their truth. But there were others who remembered them to better purpose. When despair had given place to joy at the sight of their risen Lord, the disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scriptures and the word which Jesus had said. We cannot leave this first great incident in the public ministry of Jesus without considering the anger of Christ. There are those who find this scene difficult to reconcile with the character and mission of a son who came to reveal the love of his father. That may be because there is a tendency to see, in the indignation of Jesus, a reflection of our own angry moments. Much of our anger is a revelation of weakness, not of strength. He was silent when most men would have stirred into uncontrollable fury. He was consumed with zealous indignation when most men's lips would be sealed by cowardice and their minds drugged by worldly excuses. Jesus listened in silence to the jibes of his tormentors. He allowed his enemies to tear his flesh and pierce his head with thorns. But when his Father's glory was questioned, or his brethren's welfare endangered, men quailed before the majesty of his wrath. We see in the anger of Christ an ingredient of his perfect character, which was a manifestation of the attributes of a God of goodness and severity. The purging of the temple was followed by works of power. Jesus gave abundant evidence of his authority to those who had eyes to see, and while the great majority of people living in and around the city were too greatly dominated by the priests to acknowledge him, a few precious friendships were probably formed in these early days. Many believed because they saw his works, but it was a superficial acknowledgement of his power, and that is never the best reason for following Christ. Jesus, who knew all men, did not trust himself unto them. He knew their allegiance had its source in wonder, not in belief, and he acted toward them accordingly.